offerings, and more. Your donated vehicle goes to support this unique voice for yourself and others. Have an old car taking up space in your driveway? Donate it to KPFT now. Just call 1-855-KPFT-CAR or visit kpft.org to donate your old vehicle to support KPFT. Your contribution is appreciated. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide.
You're listening to 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston. Coming up next, Technology Bites.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Greetings, welcome to Technology Bites.
Welcome to Technology Bites, everyone. We're so glad everyone who could be bothered to show up showed up. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
And he's Barrett.
Yeah.
Wow.
Groovehouse is out. Lee is out.
They know it's not fundraiser, right?
They're really kind of doing it to themselves.
I'm here.
Inflicted's here, yeah.
We were worried, though.
Well, you were, you know... Oh, look at you with your fancy DEF CON shirt.
I know. You can't buy those.
No, we were handed these.
You were gifted.
Hand-handed them.
Made just for us.
Speaker operations.
It's the cool black and white DEF CON shirt that surfaced last year,
yeah.
I think, in the swag booth. But
it's like a bowling shirt.
Ours doesn't say cool stuff on it.
Well, maybe Flicka can continue to collect those and give them away as
I'm
Christmas
pretty...
presents.
Yeah, I bet he'd do that. That's probably not his favorite DEF CON shirt.
Red would be better, or gray, but because I'm not used to wearing white. Like
anything white.
Yeah.
Well,
it's a splash of white.
It's before Labor Day, so it's fine. It's always before Labor Day. All right, well, welcome to the show. We're glad you could tune in. This is Technology Bites every Wednesday night here on KPFT. We're so glad that you could tune in. If you want to visit us online, we have one of them www's at geekradio.com.
We got us one of them.
We got us one of them trip dubs. Yeah, so we have a website and everything.
New things.
Huh?
One of them new things.
It is a new thing. You know what?
www.
So hold on. Six U's? So confusing.
Today is a special day, by the way. Today's a special day.
What's the
I think it was yesterday, the day before.
And really it was a couple of years ago, but whatever.
No.
If it's what we're thinking of, this isn't the same day we're talking about.
Well, I didn't hear you talking about a day. So I don't know what you were talking about because you weren't talking. Your phone is over there making weird noises.
It's not 25th anniversary, right, of anything? That's not what you're talking about.
No, it's an anniversary, but it's not our anniversary. Well, it's sort of our anniversary. Today is the anniversary of the release of Windows 95.
Oh, wow.
You know, and like Windows 95, we're kind of, you know, a little outdated and...
What?
will not run properly on modern hardware.
So what were the articles about the 25th anniversary of...
Well, that was people came out and said, like, hey, World Wide Web has been around for 25 years. And all that really was, again, people being wrong on the internet. But...
That was a great quote by Barrett, by the way.
Thank you.
On the supposed 25th anniversary of the World Wide Web.
So what date...
Whoa, what is that noise?
...do they put it at?
I think Pete's tuning in the internet.
He's downloading the internet.
Are you backing up the internet for us, Pete?
All right.
No, so they came out. There was a big deal, and mainly it was a handful of misguided news sources, and Facebook jumped on it, too.
I saw an article at some point.
Yeah, so the media somehow got it in their head. And actually,
But I didn't read any of the articles, so I don't know what they claimed exactly.
They're calling it Internaut Day, and what Internaut Day is supposedly the first day that, you know, Sir Tim Berners-Lee opened up the internet for the general public, which was the downfall of everything as we know. Kind of,
but
not really.
But that wasn't.
No, I know exactly it wasn't. They did it a couple years before
I saw web pages back in 93.
It was kind of...
They were horrible.
It was invite only-ish, I think. I don't know.
It was lab students.
Yeah, mostly.
That's most of what I saw.
It's definitely more than 25 years.
Was it 30? Hang on one second. Let's
we had out. Web pages, you know, I did web pages before I was doing the show.
93 was when I first saw a web page, and I think it was around 91 when...
And that's the argument, is that the HTTP...
HTML was released.
Yeah, that came up as a protocol in 91. Yeah. A solid 2 years before. It was, you know, so I guess that was, you know, it going quote-unquote commercial, or I'm sure maybe Gore had
it. Gore made it commercial.
Yeah,
That was in 90...
No, ads made it commercial.
No, hold on.
That was in 95.
So I can't believe everything I read on the internet is what I'm hearing here.
You were wrong on the internet.
Everyone's wrong on the internet. So here's the deal. Go ahead.
I don't know for sure. I know it was somewhere in 1991 that Berners-Lee released, set up the first web server, although there was no browser to browse it and no, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
There wasn't no culture around it, but it existed. I want to say 1991.
Yeah, so March 12th, 1989 is when Lee actually put together I guess it was like a proposal to CERN saying, like, here, we should do something, and let's call this the World Wide Web Foundation. So that's when it was actually founded. That was 89.
Okay.
So, like, early 89.
Okay.
By 90 and 91, they were building projects. I think they actually had the HTTP protocol was written up by October 1990. So at that point, you've got a working protocol, still don't really have a web browser, still don't have anything like that. But by the end of 1990, the very first web page was served on the open internet.
On CERN.
On CERN. No, yeah. On the actual internet.
No, but it was on a CERN
But it was on a CERN
server.
Yeah, CERN server. Yeah. So, you know, that's 90, so that's 3 years before what they're saying.
I thought they said 91.
Or 91. It's still a full year before what they're saying. I'm bad at math. Where's Dwight?
Yeah, the quick Wikipedia summary says, on August 6th, 1991, Berners-Lee posted a short summary of the World Wide Web project on the alt.hypertext news group, inviting collaborators.
So it's when he invited everyone, so, you know, come on in, the water's fine kind of a thing. It's like, you know, Linux.
So he opened it to the public.
Yeah, which was... Again, that's when people started becoming more wrong.
But it's not when things went crazy. When things went crazy was when Al Gore, because he was actually the head of the committee that made the decision to deregulate the internet. Because before 95, I think, was when it was deregulated. It was either 94 or 95. I think it was 95. Before then, you couldn't sell anything on the internet. No sales. Like, companies had... web pages, There's FTP email, stuff like that. But
I have to interrupt this broadcast.
Beep, beep.
There's some very odd noises coming through on, I don't know where it's coming
from. It's Peter.
Is it Peter?
Yeah.
Peter, have you got some kind of like a thresher going?
It's his AC bunker.
it's a little disconcerting. All right.
I turned him down some.
Turn him down some? Okay. We'll bring him back up when he talks. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Anyway, no. So Al Gore was like, I think the head of the committee, whichever committee it was, that decided to deregulate the internet. Because before that, there were companies that had some websites, but it was pretty much government, military, education, and companies that interacted, like IT kind of companies that interacted with those people. And you couldn't sell anything. It was illegal to sell, like have a web page or anything that you were selling on the internet. And Al Gore and the committee decided to deregulate it and allow that. And so that's when things started going crazy and people started putting up sites to sell stuff. And, you know, and then came everything else, eBay and Amazon and pop-up ads and all that.
He should have taken credit for it back then. I found the quote that he actually did. So this was, what was this, 80, no, 99? He was doing an interview with Wolf Blitzer, of course.
Not that he invented the internet.
No, but that's kind of what he didn't actually say that, but he said, you know, during my service in the United States Congress, I took the initiative in creating the internet. So, I mean, that is kind of, it's probably a misquote, but that's what got him in a lot of trouble, I think.
I always heard that Al Gore didn't claim that he invented the internet or whatever, but they was on the committee that deregulated it, which basically allowed its explosion from outside of, you know, military and educational community.
Well, he kind of, I mean, I'm looking at the video and he kind of says that he did.
If he said created the internet, then yeah, that's pretty
bad. And again, there was probably, you know,
what we know
is the internet. And probably up until that point, you know, he was, you know, most people, when you talk about that kind of stuff, their eyes glaze over. He probably never got called on anything technical before, and probably people had just heard of it.
Picture him with a hard hat and some Ethernet or some fiber optic cables under a desk.
Well, but the thing is,
it was just an information mediocre highway before Al Gore got here.
But the thing is,
the
internet as we know it is TCP/IP, right?
Yeah,
so the internet as
World
we know
Wide
it
Web is not internet.
Was 1969. When it was invented, right? Was late 60s and into the 70s.
I think, you know, I don't know. Maybe just speaking of, you know, what people call the internet, it was a misstatement.
Well, yeah, people call the internet web pages.
Yeah, he was born in 48, so 58. So he would have been about 25. Yeah, that's about the right age to create internet. Probably did it in his garage, maybe, you know? Maybe somewhere around Cupertino? Probably not.
I have a new thing that I'm thinking about starting up, and it's claiming copyright on all memes. Because you don't actually know who owns them or who started it. Like,
4chan.
I invented lolcats.
You should say you invented 4chan. Back when I grew up, we only had 3 channels. It's like, yeah, it's...
In my day,
4chan.
We didn't have the 4chan.
2chan was a Japanese creation, wasn't it? And then 4chan came out of a copycat of 2chan. We're still missing 3chan.
Is that the cereal, the 4chan or the toucan?
That's toucan is Fruit Loops. This gotten really esoteric.
And maybe those are related in some way.
The Fruit Loops and Al Gore? Possibly. I think we just connected all the dots here. Yeah, it's full circle here.
See, there's no way to verify any of it. I invented a Rofflecopter.
Well, just create a Wikipedia article that says you did it.
That makes it true.
No, there's got to be some guy out there who goes, you know, I think I might be the first person who ever typed LOLCAT. He's out there somewhere.
It was probably a cat walking on a keyboard.
All right. Well, again, thanks for tuning in. We do have a web page, and that was a nice digression.
Digression?
I invented speech.
I invented a word.
You invented a word.
Yes, that was a nice digression.
It's a digression and a migration at the same time.
Al Sharpton's on line one. He said no. He said it first.
No, but, you know, happy birthday, Windows 95, and we're just going to reinstall this show on top of itself.
So you guys bought it on day one? I went to Micro Center.
At Best Buy when it was
released.
So
did you guys have a lot of people through the door?
It was a big deal.
Did you guys do the midnight thing? Like, I want to say Micro Center did the midnight thing.
I don't think Best Buy did the midnight thing. I remember getting the first boxes of it in and installing it for the first time on OpenGL.
Wasn't that where they had, didn't they have the thing where they were pushing where you'd have to have parties to install it, and they had like CDs?
Install
they,
parties?
Was that Windows 95 or was that Windows 98?
I thought that was Linux.
I thought there was something where they were suggesting that. Maybe that was Windows 98. I just know there was one point in that particular kind of that version, you know, that
where they wanted
type
parties
of software before NT, where they were suggesting that then that people could have, you know, you could set up a party to install.
I don't think people were that, there was that many people that were that enthused.
I think they were trying to catch the kind of Apple lineup, and
someone went to one of those parties.
Yeah, the dogs did.
Well,
I know that they probably pitched some stuff. I remember how PC had a big thing. Maybe they were doing some stuff like that. But I'm Googling for Windows 95 and 98 install parties and not finding a lot. At least no current ones. None this week. That's sad.
I'm trying to remember if there was a direct upgrade path from Windows 3.1 to 95.
I think I just installed clean.
I remember there were a lot of people that wanted Windows 95 on their computer when it came out, because it was so...
It was different. It changed everything. Windows 3, I mean...
It hinted at the plug-and-play that was supposed to be there.
Now, I don't think that it's changed very much since then, honestly. Like, Windows, even though everyone freaked out about 8, and Windows 10 has some tablet stuff built in, Windows has kind of looked like Windows since 95 to me.
No, there was a direct upgrade path. No, it's just a music with there's screen grabs of how to upgrade Windows 3.1 to Windows 95. Yes.
There is. I found a video. I don't know if that's what you're watching. There is a video of someone upgrading from Windows 1.01 to Windows 8 in 4 minutes. So it just goes through the entire direct upgrade path. Now, I don't know if they hit Windows 95 A, B, and C, and they hit all the minors, but they probably, you know, they probably jumped the majors in there.
Do they have ME in there?
I may fire this up.
I don't think it's going to have good audio. It never does. All right. So anyway, IRC is also where we hang out because, you know, to heck with Twitter. IRC.cuckoo.com and the channel Tech Bytes.
Cuckoo. You can't really hang out in Twitter.
No, not really. I mean, no, not really.
You can
really
watch Twitter or something, but you can't really hang out.
You don't
out.
Hang.
Because there's not really like rooms or con. I mean, you could do a hashtag so you're sharing some experience, but.
No, there's
bird watching.
Yeah, no. IRC, you could hang out.
Windows 3.10 upgrade was ugly. I forgot how ugly those. They were DOS screens, more or less, to do the install.
DOS screens to which operator?
For Windows 3.10. It looks like it kicks you back out to straight DOS. Yeah.
Where's Windows?
It was 3.10 and 3.11. 3.10 was just straight. Windows 3.11 had networking baked in. Windows 3.11 was
3.0.
Yeah.
Not 3.10.
Oh, there wasn't a 3.10? Hold on.
I don't think there's a Windows 3.10. I mean, I don't want to go out on a limb too far, but I don't think there's a Windows 3.10.
Yeah, 3.1. Well, I'm calling it 3.10. It's just 3.1. Janus.
Or 3. Oh, wait. Whatever.
Well, so Windows, I think 3 came out, and then it stalled at 3.10, and then 3.11 was the very last little kernel they gave us before they swapped over into 95.
It was 3.1. No, .0.
Damn it. Windows 3.1 million. Number of significant digits? They're not significant enough.
It was 3.1.0.1.
3.0.
We're very close to the the 21st anniversary of the first stable release of Microsoft Bob.
There was a stable one?
That came out. The 1.0A stable release came out on August 30th, 1995.
I'm trying to remember what the... what Packard Bell... Packard Bell had an overlay for Windows 3.1.1 that was their own interface, that their own way of interacting with the operating system.
Ooh, Compaq had one. They had that Compaq Plaza.
Oh, yeah.
Where was that fountain in the center? And then there was like a, it looked like it was a town square, and there was like a library and a game store, and I don't remember what else.
Those things were the worst things ever made in terms
they were
of
horrible.
Well, not only did they suck
and it made
not
sound
work well,
because the fountain bubbled and like,
but they
chewed up CPU. They messed up your boot
They put a real block on people's ability to interact with their operating system. Yeah. So once you got somebody who had one of those and then they had to replace computers and they just got a regular Windows interface,
where's the town square?
It was horrifying. You know, one of the first things I ever learned was how to shell out of that. Mm-hmm. And I remember my mother was the same way. When she had one of her first computers, it was a computer provided to her by Avon, because she worked for Avon. She sold Avon. And they gave her a computer, one of the first computers, and they had their own proprietary screen to interact with the computer to put in order. It wasn't online or anything. You would put in order information, you'd print it
and mail it.
You would, yes.
Interject really, really shortly. Have you ever listened to the Drive-By Truckers do the song about the Avon lady?
No.
You should listen to it because...
Because it's about my mom.
It's hilarious, and it may or may not be about your mom.
But my mother was very computer inquisitive, and she knew she had
there were little animals inside there.
No, she had the hacker instinct. She knew that that was not the direct interface to the computer, and she wanted to get out of it. So she found her way out of it and got to like a DOS shell, but then she couldn't figure out how to get back. So they had to keep coming out or sending somebody to her, call her on the phone and walk her through getting it back working until we finally got her own computer. But yeah, she could break.
She only hacked halfway.
She broke. She had the broke part of broke fix or break fix down. She could break it.
And the teams that built all those interfaces, you know where they are now? They're doing interfaces for Android phones at every different manufacturer and for the various phone companies.
I remember one poor woman when I, you know, she had her computer and I shelled out of the out of that interface and showed her, you know, I started working on it. She thought I was really messing things up. Wow.
So did you guys play any games in Windows 3.10 or Windows 3 anything? Windows 3.1?
I think I might have played... Oh, what was that called?
Aside from Minesweeper and Solitaire.
It was a golf game.
There was a starfighter or space fighting game and with the cats, and I keep forgetting the name of it, the cat people.
That sounds fun.
The one race that you... God, what was the name of that game? And
randomly stringing words together so far.
No, it was... It was a first-person fighter pilot game where you got into some kind of fighter that was...
Rodent's Revenge?
No.
No, okay. Oh, that's fun. I just looked okay.
Hold on. Rodent's Revenge. Oh, that's fun. I'll save that for later.
We're playing that later.
Oh,
Cats flying planes?
Cats. It was the race of beings that were in this game where you were... being a starfighter were cat-like creatures. And I can't remember. And I remember it was like 20 discs, 25 and a quarter floppy discs to install.
I remember buying games, and you'd literally lift the box, and the contents of the box would shift, and there would be like that many discs.
Yes.
And we're installing, you know, something like that. Literally would be an afternoon of just feeding discs, disc after disc after disc.
Yeah,
I didn't play a lot of games in Windows 3. I think I was still shelling out to DOS at that point and still messing with HiMemSys and still messing with all that stuff, because I don't think that at least the computer I had was powerful enough to do both.
I played some game that was a golf game.
What was that?
Run on 3.1? Wasn't Doom on top of Windows 3.1?
Yes. Doom could be played on top of Windows. Anything that was basically DOS, it would have to, again, I'm loving this term, shell out of Windows. So it would have to kill off the Windows process and load the game. And some of the games were clever enough to restart Windows when you were done. I'm going to find this.
Wolfenstein?
Wolfenstein.
Not enough cats. Not enough cats.
No, it wasn't Wolfenstein. I'll find it eventually.
No, Wolfenstein didn't have cats.
It had Nazis,
it had
which
dogs.
Were the same thing. What?
It had
oh,
dogs.
Yeah. Dogs.
German Shepherds.
Oh, no,
I don't remember any cats flying planes.
They weren't like kitty cats. They were like cat people. Or like, you know, they had like,
Were they called lolcats?
No. I didn't invent that.
I thought
till
we were
going to
find an origin story.
I did not invent that until later. Oh, now I got to find it, but I won't. All right. So anyway, you can hang out on IRC, irc.cuckoo.com. Cuckoo says Groovehouse is not here. All right. Aww. So let's do this. I'm going to go Googling. We'll do the Technology Bytes info shot from San Antonio. Take it away, info shot.
It's the Technology Bytes Info Shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
So it's interesting how things change with technology, and that, you know, there's the whole kind of Facebook activating the stuff for, you know, when there's an event somewhere where people can check on their loved ones and that. This one, this is the first time I've heard of this. There was the earthquake in Italy, in central Italy, in the middle of the night, last night, 6.2 magnitude earthquake, killed at least 120 people and trapped a bunch of others. This is the part that's interesting in new technology thing. The local disaster relief institutions are urging local people to temporarily remove their Wi-Fi passwords so that then the rescuers, Red Cross, and all that can use the Wi-Fi that's all around. Apparently there are problems with phone lines where they're often clogged, and so that people who are in immediate need of help struggle to get in touch. So then passwordless Wi-Fi connections allow organizations like the Lazio region and Italian Red Cross to quickly facilitate mobile communication by contacting people through WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, and Skype. Obviously, you know, if you open your Wi-Fi, you can potentially expose your personal data to third parties. But, you know, what kind of person is cruising around war driving through an earthquake zone to try and pick up bad stuff? I would think most people are probably too busy dealing with the disaster at hand. So just an interesting one. So something to think about. If there's a big disaster around you, maybe people should consider opening up their Wi-Fi so that then more, you know, it gives another avenue for people to communicate. Let's see. And this one is just, it's sort of just, it's interesting that it's happened, and hopefully it will happen more and closer to wherever you're listening to us from, especially if you're maybe on a podcast. And I know Google Fiber is coming to San Antonio. Apparently they have lit up Salt Lake City. They're live in Salt Lake City and ready to serve the internet needs of Utah's capital. They made the announcement Tuesday in a tweet that invited residents to check whether the super high-speed internet and TV services are available at their address, and they can sign up for the service. 1 gigabit service will run $70 per month, while 100 megabits per second service will cost $50 per month, and neither has data caps. If you do TV and phone, that costs extra. Google Fiber is Google's attempt to shake up internet access in the United States, which Ookla ranks 27th across the world in terms of internet speeds. Google's goal is to create faster internet performance for consumers and businesses and ultimately boost its profits, but they also hope the service will spur innovation among people who find unique ways to use the high-speed network. 1 gigabit per second, or 1,000 megabits per second, if you want to math it out that way, Google Fiber is blazingly faster than the average internet connection. The average broadband speed in the U.S. is 34 megabits per second, according to Ookla. So comparing 34 megabits or 1,000, you can kind of figure out which is better. And so hopefully, you know, one of the things that happens, a side effect when Google comes in with gigabit, is the other providers will usually they kick up their game. They lower their prices and they raise their speeds. And so, you know, hopefully Google will get to do this more often in more places and we can all benefit from it. And then a couple other Google stories. Google is using artificial intelligence to compress images in a better way than JPEG. You know, obviously on the internet, if you compress an image, it's easier to transmit and store it. And now Google is using neural networks to beat JPEG at the compression game. They begin by taking a random sample of 6 million 1280 by 720 images on the web. It then broke them down into non-overlapping 32 by 32 tiles and zeroed in on 100 of those with the worst compression ratios. The goal there was essentially to focus improving performance on the hardest to compress stuff, because that's going to be the place where you get the most out of it, and it makes it easier to succeed on on the easy stuff. Researchers then used the TensorFlow machine learning system that Google open sourced last year to train a set of experimental neural network architectures. They used 1 million steps to train them and then collected a series of technical metrics to find which training models got the best compressed results. In the end, they did their models outdid the JPEG compression standards performance on average. The next challenge will be to beat compression methods derived from video compression codecs on large images because, quote, they employ tricks such as reusing patches that were already decoded. WebP, which was devised from the VP8 video codec, is an example of that. The researchers did note, however, that it's not always easy to define a winner when it comes to compression performance because technical metrics don't always agree with the human eye. But there's something where, literally artificial intelligence could benefit us all with smaller file sizes and hopefully better results of better results on what we see, you know, that's there from once they compress stuff. And then
about a minute early there.
8:30. Yeah. So for those listening at home, those playing along at home, the VoIP connection to Peter Hughes in San Antonio typically just goes away for no good reason at around 8:32. Now it's you just came back, Pete.
At 31:17.
You were gone for about 35 seconds or so. So right after 8:30, yeah. So we hadn't had that. It hadn't happened in a while.
Did you experience any loss of time?
What's happened is we haven't had the news going over that part of the time frame because last week you guys were cutting out, but I just stayed silent.
Right.
So it didn't.
I wonder if it's a buffering issue.
It's always at the same time.
It's really noticeable when he's doing his monologue, the news and stuff. So if it's us all just carrying on, then you don't necessarily, it still fades out, but we don't notice it. All right, so rewind to about 35 seconds ago? Oh, he's gone again.
Really?
And it's 8:32.
And it is 8:32. Okay, that's more like it. Now we're back on
awesome.
Our game.
Awesome, yeah. The universe is keeping all things right with Pete fading out.
It was still going.
There you are.
Yeah, I disappeared, and it got kind of, you sounded kind of robotic, and then it came back for a second, and Barrett said, really? And then it went out again. So let's see. Did you hear the Google Fiber part?
You're just going into that, I think.
Okay. Well, I guess long story short, Google's lit up the fiber in Salt Lake City. It's $70 a month for 1 gigabit internet, and the average speed of most people's internet that they pay for at home is 34 megabit, where Google Fiber is 1,000 megabit, just so you have a nice little comparison. And that's the $70. So just do the math yourself. Look at what your internet connection is and think, are you paying more than $70? And if you are, how many gigabits or megabits of data transfer are you getting? And then if you're not getting 1,000, you can hope that that Google Fiber comes to your town. Because when they do, the competitors like Comcast and Charter and Time Warner and AT&T will raise their speeds and lower their prices to kind of account for it. So good luck on them. And then Android Nougat is out now, the new operating system for phones and tablets. But unfortunately, unless you've got a Nexus device, you're going to have to wait a few months. Most Android phone owners will likely receive a notification to update their phone's operating system sometime between November and January. Apparently manufacturers or carriers, when Wired tried to contact them, none of them could give a specific date when Nougat would show up on their phones. They won't even ballpark it. Oops. So that's sort of the sad side of the Android stuff, unless you buy it from Google, or you know, make sure you get a Nexus device, you're kind of at the mercy of your phone or of your phone manufacturer, and your who your cellular carrier is if it's a phone. So sad on that, but apparently there are a lot of good features in NuGet, and you apparently have several months, unless you've got a Nexus, you have several months to look at them and marvel at them on other people's existing Google phones. Let's see. And then the final Android thing, this one, it's like, I didn't realize this, but apparently there is an Android botnet, or at least there may be more than one, but there's one that's made the news. You know, cause there's Android malware out there. We knew that. But apparently the interesting different thing about this is it is using Twitter to communicate. So it infects your smartphone and then uses Twitter to have the communication. Let's see, security firm ESET found the feature in a malicious app called Android Twitter, T-W-I-T-O-O-R. It runs as a backdoor virus that can secretly install other malware on a phone. How nice. Typically, the makers of Android malware control their infected smartphones from servers. Commands sent from those servers can create a botnet of compromised phones and tell the malware on all the phones what they want it to do. The makers of Android Twitter, I guess, decided to use Twitter instead of servers to communicate with the infected phones. The malware routinely checks certain Twitter accounts and reads the encrypted posts to get its operating commands. So it's kind of like the Internet of Things, but it's the malware, the Twitter net of malware. Lucas Stefanko, an ESET researcher, said in a blog post that it was an innovative approach. It removes the need to maintain a command and control server, and the communications with the Twitter accounts can be hard to discover. So it's harder to trace it down. You can't, obviously, if they like hard code the address of the control server, then if you get into the malware, you can find, you know, you can find out where it's getting its commands from and stop it, you know, shut that off, block that IP, whatever, where this is a lot tougher. So they can redirect communications to a new account, you know, as needed. So ESET said this was the first Twitter-controlled Android botnet it had ever found. Windows-based botnets using Twitter have been around since at least 2009. So that's nice. ESET said that Android/Twitter hasn't been detected in any app stores, so it probably spreads through malicious links sent to the victim. It's malware that pretends to be a porn player or multimedia messaging app, and it's only been active for about a month. So far, it's been found downloading versions of mobile banking malware to users' phones. So, you know, the other thing is for the communication in the future, we're looking at, according to ESET, they're looking at use of Facebook statuses or LinkedIn or other social networks to be the command and control for malware. So, I don't know. That might be an interesting movie plot or something someday, but not fun if you're one of the ones that's been compromised. And finally, this one is sort of weird. The researchers at the University College of London and the University of Bristol did a test with people working with robots. And they found that human beings prefer robots that are expressive and apologetic, even if they're less efficient than a more robotic, you know, silent alternative. They said that that people are more likely to forgive a robot's shortcomings if they think criticism or flat-out rejection will upset them. There should be quotes around that. In a test lab, BERT 2, a humanoid robot with three separate displays, which allowed its eyes and mouth to express various emotions, performed in three different ways. One was silent and made zero mistakes, while a second was mute and programmed to make a single mistake, which it would then correct quietly. And then a third one was able to speak and accept simple yes or no responses from the user. In a basic kitchen scenario, the vocal android would apologize for its mistakes, like after it dropped an egg, and give a heads up when it was about to try a new technique. It was the slowest of the three robots, and it was the one that most people preferred. But then the real interesting part is at the end of the exchange, the robot would ask for a job. Some participants were reluctant to say no, even if they preferred the silent, more efficient robot, because they thought it would upset the machine. Quote, "It felt appropriate to say no, but I felt really bad saying it," one of the test participants said. "When the face was really sad, I felt even worse. I felt bad because the robot was trying to do its job." Just think about that for a minute. So here's your tip for the week. If you're going to build a robot, if it's a good, efficient robot, you don't have to do anything on the emotional front. But if your robot is really going to kind of suck, you need to make sure that you program it so that it looks sad, and that it acts like it's, you know, that it triggers that response from people, so that they don't get angry at it, and, you know, because they'll apparently forgive it if it sucks, if it apologizes and acts sad. And that's the news.
All right, Wing Commander. That was the name of the
game. It was one of the races you could play.
It was one of the races you played against, I believe. I can't remember exactly now, but there was Wing Commander 1, 2, and 3, and I think there might be a new Wing Commander coming out with up-to-date.
And there was a movie of it, too, with, Freddie Prinze Jr., I think.
Was that Wing Commander?
The movie? Yeah, it sure was. 1999 sci-fi film. Unfortunately, two stars on Rotten Tomatoes, IMDb. Yeah, Freddie Prinze Jr., Matthew Lillard. I recognize no other names. But yes, post-production was done in Austin, Texas.
And it set off a whole slew of... It was so successful, it did not set off a whole slew of video game-based movies. There were a few attempts. I mean, you know, Tron, I guess, was real early. And then there was The Last Starfighter, and then sort of this. But there's not been a lot of... not been a lot of video games that made the jump.
Kilrathi was the name of the cat race.
Kilrathi. Yes.
And they were seeking the complete eradication of the human race.
With, hence the reason to fight them.
Yeah.
That was the impetus. Because as
killer
a human,
cats.
Kill the cats. Because really, all cats want to do is eradicate the human race.
Unless it's food time.
Well, if it comes down to it, you're food time.
I believe that.
It's true. They have found dead cat ladies.
Dead cat ladies. I would assume they would not have found the dead cat ladies.
Well, he found the remains of dead cat ladies. Yes, so Wing Commander.
Oh, Mr. Whiskers.
Oh.
Poor little cat. All right, so, it's just weird not having Groovehouse here, even though he doesn't say too much. I miss him. And then Lee, who says too much.
So yeah, Wing Commander spent. I'm sorry, Pete.
No, I guess you're hoping that Lee's not listening.
I don't
but
care.
He's probably talking anyway, so he wouldn't hear it.
He can listen if he wants to, and I don't have any problem bad mouthing him on the air.
They spent $30 million on Wing Commander, and it made less than 12.
On the movie?
On the movie, yeah. Oh. Budget was $30 million. Box office $11.5 million.
Okay, this Ouch. Week, speaking of things that are horrible that yet we enjoy, this past weekend, I watched two movies because for some reason, my wife, who has historically been terrified of spiders, has come around to actually enjoying looking at them. I mean, she would not go in the same room as that may or may not have a spider in it not long ago, but now she's fascinated. She, the 1950s classic Tarantula, she loved. And so this weekend we watched two movies that were available through streaming services. One of them, literally the name was Big Ass Spider, which is...
What was that movie about, Jay?
It was about a big ass spider, and it was pretty well done, and it was kind of funny. It did not take itself seriously, and it was a sci-fi movie release, and it was pretty good, and I enjoyed it, especially the Mexican security guard sidekick. It was definitely, you know, one of those ones that if you really want to have a mindless movie romp, go watch that movie. It's free on Comcast. And then the other one that we watched was Lava Lantula, which was about this lava spitting spiders that burrowed up into Los Angeles. Both of the movies were set in Los Angeles. Los Angeles has a terrible time with spiders. But Lavalantula.
Lava-breathing tarantulas.
Yes.
That's a concern.
That's, you know, that if you're not afraid of spiders, you may be afraid of lava. They're just going to attack you from every angle they possibly can. But, yeah, those are two good movies to watch. And there's a sequel to Lavalantula, which I have queued up for later. It's Two Lava, Two Lantula.
Really?
Yes.
I'm going to have to fact check you on that.
Fact check me on what? Numeral two lava, numeral two lava.
No, Google auto-pop that. Yeah, two lava. Oh,
wow. We probably need to jump on the Lavalantula bandwagon, and we can have the next movie can be where the Lavalantula attacks a coffee plantation and gains the powers of coffee, and it can be Java Lavalantula.
Java Lavalantula. No, you laugh now, but 20 years from now, there's going to be Lavalantula conventions.
Someone probably laughed at Sharknado, too. Oh, I did. That's right.
Yeah.
Sharknado 2. They stopped laughing by Sharknado 4, right?
Is there more than
there's
two of them?
There's four. At least four. I think they're coming out with one a year. There was at Comic-Con last year, they were doing a big promotion of it out there with women dressed in shark suits and guys up on stilts dressed as Uncle Sam with sharks coming out of their bellies and saying, "Oh, hell no." So, yeah. Sharknado.
Well, you know, since they stopped doing the Love Boat, then, like, out of work former B-list actors don't have a lot of places to go, and
Lavalantula
dangles a few bucks in a contract. And
the meta nature of Lavalantula is that the hero of the movie is a B-rated actor. In fact, the character was a B-rated actor playing a B-rated actor. he was from the Police Academy movies, and they also had the sound effects guy. So they had at least three of the original cast from the Police Academy movies in Lavalantula, and the one B actor from the Police Academy movie, his character was a B movie actor, washed up, you know, guy. And,
well, that's great to see Steve Guttenberg getting some work. Oh, I'm betting it wasn't him.
It was Steve Guttenberg.
Oh, was it?
Yes.
I was joking.
No, it was Steve Guttenberg. So you say B-rate movie from Police Academy, you knew exactly who I was talking about.
Does Guttenberg know he's a B-list actor?
The problem with the Police Academy movies is figuring out which B actor you're talking about, though.
Yeah, that's the thing. Oh, and one more. There was a movie we watched called Spiders, which was filmed in 3D, but we didn't have the 3D version to watch, which would have probably made it even better, which is about these spiders that were being bred in space by covert scientists and they got out on the space station and killed everybody on the, they didn't really show it. They just hinted at it, but then they came to Earth when the spaceship ended up colliding with a Soyuz craft. And then, so they came and landed in the subways of New York. So they had to deal with that. It was a three spider movie, triple play. And
I wonder if Arachnophobia is still floating around.
It's still out there. I
can't remember if that was good or not. I saw it in the theater. I remember kind of liking it, Tom Hanks, but I don't remember much more. All I can conjure up now are thoughts of the Burbs.
Was it Tom Hanks?
Oh, it wasn't? Are you sure?
It was John Goodman and somebody, I think.
You could look it up. Tom Hanks. I don't think. No.
Jeff Daniels, John Goodman.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it was good for its time. It's definitely did not age well. So that's going to have to be one to go back and watch, because that was one of the first spider movies I tried to show her, and she couldn't get through the first part. So, but now it's kind of campy and fun. But it was kind of seriously frightening when it came out. Of course, Jaws was seriously frightening when it came out. At least I read the book before I saw the movie.
I was scared when I was a kid.
I didn't like it. I didn't like going into the... I mean, there's enough terror in the ocean in Galveston anyway that's not necessarily related to animals. Well, to sort of animals, but I would not go into the water for a while after reading Jaws. All right, so...
Isn't that in the tar balls? Yeah, keep
the tar balls, and then, you know, whatever spring break flushes into the, into the bay.
It's the remains of some kind of MTV festival at the beach.
All right, so.
All right. Should we do another seg?
We should do another seg. I've As talked about say all the Spider movies I can.
Bite of the apple.
Okay, well, we'll start with we'll do the iPhone stuff first, and then we'll do the non-iPhone stuff. This one's bad news. I guess it doesn't really count as a rumor. Apparently, iPhone 6s and iPhone 6 Pluses are having a growing number of complaints from people suffering from what appears to be a manufacturing issue that presents as a gray flickering bar at the top of the screen and a display that's unresponsive or less responsive to touch. According to iFixit, a number of third-party repair outlets have seen iPhone 6 and 6 Plus models affected by the bug, which appears to be very common. One tech in Louisiana sees up to 100 iPhone 6 and 6 Pluses that don't respond well to touch. Another one says he sees them multiple times a week. iFixit is calling the problem touch disease and says Apple appears to be aware of the issue based on dozens of complaints on their support forum, but, quote, isn't doing anything about it. Multiple people who brought their phones to Apple stores were told that Apple doesn't recognize it as an issue and nothing could be done as their phones were out of warranty. Ooh. Replacing the display does not work to fix it, as the problem is said to be caused by the touchscreen controller chips that are soldered to the logic board of the phone, and it's possible the damage is caused by the same structural design flaw that caused the major Bendgate controversy. Apparently, let's see, quote, it says that the Touch IC chips connect to the logic board via an array of itty bitty solder balls, like a plate resting on marbles. Over time, as the phone flexes or twists slightly during normal use, those solder balls crack and start to lose contact with the board. So apparently the only way to fix it is to replace the phone, replace the logic board, or replace the Touch ICs on the logic board. Something that Apple's in-house repair staff is not able to do. So if you find early symptoms of touch disease, an intermittently non-functional touchscreen, or hints of a gray bar, get your iPhone to an Apple store if it's still under warranty and get that sucker replaced. Get that puppy replaced. You don't want to, if you're out of warranty, you don't want to go to Apple, at least until you find out if you hear that they're actually addressing the problem, because they won't, if they haven't officially acknowledged it, they won't fix it. And then other phone stuff. This one's more in the rumors front. A fake iPhone SE packaging showed up, presumably countering rumors that the next iPhone will be called the iPhone 7. But apparently the photos were quite clearly digitally altered. So they circulated around on a number of sites with varying amounts of redaction, but the highest quality, least edited versions that Mac Rumors found were shared by frequent Weibo leaker KK, who notes he collected them from other users and doesn't believe Apple will use iPhone 6 SE as the name. So if you've seen those around, you can probably blow those off as far as being likely. And then this one's for not the one for September, but for 2017, the rumors have started appearing that the next phone, not the one coming out next month, but the one next year, would have a curved OLED screen, in the high end at least. Is the rumor. I don't know why. I don't know how beneficial knowing that or what the deal. It corroborates reports from KGI Securities analyst Ming-Chi Kuo, who said Apple may launch the next-gen iPhone with a curved AMOLED display and glass casing in 2017. So we'll keep an eye on that one. But, I mean, you know, it's more than a year away, and it's two models away. So, you know, I guess we'll let that one cook a little while. And then a couple other non-phone things. The Apple Watch there'd been some rumors talking about, you know, would it have cellular on it? And the, you know, there's also been the pushback that it wasn't going to. Well, this latest rumor says that power demands for cellular data chips mean that they can't get the kind of battery life out of the watch that they want. And so it definitely will need a phone if you want to do phone type stuff. Apparently Apple is still reportedly studying lower power cellular data chips for future generations. The next watch will rely on your iPhone. There is an indication that Apple's going to have GPS in the new Apple Watch in the next generation. So there's some benefit to that. It's expected some point in the fall, possibly at the iPhone event that's rumored to happen September 7th. WatchOS 3, a major revamp of the operating system, will also be released this fall as an update for existing Apple Watch owners. And then finally, this one's sort of a mix of hardware, software stuff. Code discovered within the macOS Sierra beta suggests that the operating system will include support for second generation USB 3.1, which gives you transfer speeds of up to 10 gigabytes per second, hinting at hardware upgrades that could be included in future Macs set to be released later this year. Found in a localizable text string in macOS Sierra by 9to5 Mac, the code points to support for Super Speed Plus, another name for the faster 10 gigabits per second USB 3.1 Gen 2 specification, and obviously a lot quicker to say. Current Macs only support current Macs and El Capitan, the current operating system, only support the current generation USB 3.1, which is capable of getting up to 5 gigabits per second or so. So the obvious conclusion is that there's new hardware support coming on new machines. So we'll keep our eyes out for that one. That doubling the speed that you can transfer data in would be nice. Let's see, rumors have also previously suggested...
We've got a break for the top of the hour. I don't know if you're hearing the music or not. Sorry to interrupt you.
Now I hear it. Once you started talking.
Once I made you stop and listen.
So that's all the rumors. So,
all right. Good first hour, everybody. Good first hour. And we're going to take a short break here, take care of some station business. And we'll be right back after that. You're listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
And I'm Barrett.
Barrett, yeah, we are broken up.
KPFT's effort to elect a new board of directors is underway, and we've begun broadcasting statements by candidates for seats to that board. Over the election period, candidates may make remarks about the station and its parent organization. Please note these opinions may not reflect the position of Pacifica or KPFT. You are encouraged to research claims and to cast an informed vote. You can visit Pacifica's election website for complete candidate statements. KPFT needs your support. Make a secure donation anytime at kpft.org. Thank you for listening. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
As a KPFT listener, you have a special opportunity to shorten on-air fundraising by pre-pledging securely online at kpft.org before the on-air portion of the drive begins. We count on listeners like you to contribute to the success of each fund drive, and we thank you for your generous and continued support of KPFT. Since listeners' support is what sustains the station, on-air pledge drives are necessary to inspire other KPFT listeners to become listener supporters. But wouldn't it be nice if the on-air portion of the pledge drive were a bit shorter? With your online gift, you can help shorten the on-air drive so we can get you back to the KPFT programming you enjoy. Pre-pledge securely online at kpft.org so that we have it in hand in time to create the final on-air schedule. And thank you again for your continued support of 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide.
You're listening to 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston. We now return to Technology Bites.
Yay, we're back. You know, we never actually leave because we're just sitting here waiting for...
It's an illusion. It's the magic of radio.
But since the listeners don't have object permanence.
Peekaboo!
Can't see me.
Now we're gone. Now we're back.
It's like we went, you know, gallivanting for 2 minutes. Or however long that might have seemed to you when you were listening to it. All right, hour two of Technology Bites. And we
probably should suggest that people, if you want to support the show, next week there's going to be a mini drive.
Is it next week?
Make up some shortage. Yes, next week.
Yes, that's right. So if you want to help us make our goal ahead of time, if you go to kpft.org and make a donation on the tip jar, you can support public radio, support KPFT, and support Technology Bites. And whatever we make during the week from web pledges, we won't have to raise during the show. It'd be so weird doing a fundraiser without Ernesto. I mean, even though he isn't always here for us.
And it's a single episode deal, so
see, you know, Lee and Groovehouse don't realize what they've done. Lee and Groovehouse, they just said, "Okay, we're going to just randomly take a day off."
Silly kids.
And in case you're planning like, "Oh, it's a drive, so I'm not going to listen next week." The Geek Gathering is next Friday.
Yeah.
So just go ahead and put it in your calendar. You know, just in case you're not here next week,
to listen
or
to
you turn it on and we're like, "Hey, fun drive,
click."
Just know next Friday is Geek Gathering, so go ahead
and
mark
that. It's going to be a good Geek Gathering, right, Barrett? We're counting on you. You're the star. You and David.
We'll bring stuff. We got some stuff in at DEF CON. We'll bring out what we have and show off what we have. We'll bring out some badges. We'll bring out some booklets. We'll bring out, you know, some stuff.
Okay.
And also, I know that 2600 has their meeting that same night, as does, you know, some of the hacker spaces. But if anyone would like to come out that doesn't usually attend a Geek Gathering and check out some DEF CON hackery stuff, please do.
Are we going to recruit them to come over after that?
We're talking about stuff and probably some stuff we shouldn't. Yeah, we can talk about this on air. There's talk of doing, like, you know, how we've got DEF CON in Vegas, and there's a lot of Houstonians that go to DEF CON.
Yeah.
And I don't see those people unless we're in Vegas for the most part. So we're going to be talking with a lot of the Houston groups, the different 2600 groups, the different DEF CON, 713, DEF CON, I assume there's a 281, everyone, and possibly try to do a 1 to 2 day security con. Or HackerCon, which is more fun than an information security con here in Texas, or here in Houston, rather.
Wow.
So stay tuned for that. Now, that may or may not happen. We are going to try to make it happen, but we're in the process of trying to... And actually, this probably will happen because our friend from DEF CON, Emily, is helping us organize and check with other cons around the country and make sure that we don't pick anything the right day. She stepped in. We were going to do something in February, and she's like, "Wait, hotels in February because the rodeo." No. So far, she's just a big bag of no. But it's good because otherwise we'd probably, you know,
it's a great unexecuted idea so far. No, that
so far,
that'd be cool.
But we've got enough people to do it. We've got, even if we just recycle talks,
we could
people
talk to
other places.
We could talk to. There's a lot of local software companies we could talk to. We could talk to the people over at Alert Logic. Talk to the people over at NetIQ.
What if we need a goon?
We got a goon.
Oh, we got a goon. That's awesome.
And as a fundraiser, we could have illegal underground slot machines.
Pete's in charge of that, FCC.
Oh, no, somebody who stole my identity is doing it.
No, we can have terminals set up for online poker.
We could just do a little capture the flag tournament. I don't know.
We could get the maker people to come out. All right, now I want to do this.
This would be fun. I mean, you know, do a few different things.
What would we call it? We have to come up with a name.
Oh,
we'd have to
figure
it out right now, but we need a good name.
See, if you flip deaf, then it could be FedCon.
Yeah, let's just go to a buffet and bring our computers
to a
buffet.
Fednock.
We kicked around, so there's B-sides. We kicked around C-sides and doing it in Galveston, but that's...
C-sides is funny.
I thought that was kind of good.
Clever.
What about, yeah, that was me.
What about third side? Because, you know, we're third coast. There's usually two sides to something and a third side.
Three sides to every argument. There's more than that on the internet. But yeah, this is... So anyone that's interested, we'll talk more about this on air.
Can
but
we have
yeah.
Godwin's Law Fest?
Oh, I'm sure it'll devolve into that super, super quick. Everything... The internet is Godwin's Law Fest.
We can something, call something. It Schrodinger's Fest. It's on. It's off. It's on. It's
you won't
off.
Know
you
until
know
you show
until
up.
You get there yeah. and
is
open
there a
the
con?
Door.
You guys don't know until it's observed or not observed. Oh, yes. Dog
cat,
con.
Cat.
Cat. Dog con. All right. So we got another.
Squirrel. Hacker squirrel. Hacker squirrel. Jeez.
Yes, they're all just laying right behind my desk. And so if anything sets them off.
And what
they're
what
right the, there. Oh, right by, in the right in the field of that of the microphone.
How do what sets them off? Do you like uncross your legs so that causes
any,
them to...
any random sound outside or outside of the room? Or...
Oh, I meant to ask you, didn't San Antonio have some flooding issues? How did you fare during all? I guess you're okay because you would have mentioned, hey, I can't be on the air tonight.
He's on the second floor.
Hey now, I actually
put my microphone on the top shelf and my neck. I'm up to my neck in water, but no, we're not in a part where.
Okay, now I know somebody who you know, that flooding out that we've had here in Houston the last couple of months. They're still having problems out over by Highway 6, and I know I know this woman who is they. Whole bottom of the half their house was flooded, and they were living in six people living in two rooms upstairs while the house was being renovated. And they finally got the inspection passed. But a lot of people aren't rebuilding out there.
They have dead horses or cattle on the first floor?
Not yet. Not this time. I know that. Yeah, you're referencing a story you talked about previously. No, there was no dead. They didn't use horses or cattle to wait down their house.
In the late 90s and early 2000s, I lived up in Conroe, up near San Jacinto River. Well, near, like a mile away from it, but it was a mile that was not very, the distance in depth was not very far. And so twice we got flooded out of our house and we were renting. And the second time it's like, we're done. And ever since then, of course, we've been very careful about making sure that there's not any chance. Cause we've done our share on that, on the flood thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. The second time it was a real treat because it was like the first I got laid off. And it was the first, you and I met with somebody that wanted to like do a TV show with Technology Bites on like a Monday morning. It was the first day after I was laid off, you know, the first day I didn't have to go into work, and went home that night, and overnight the house flooded. It's just funny. But yeah, so it was kind of like, yeah, that it was enough. So I pay very close attention to where's the floodplain, what's the possibilities in any place that I end up now. So there's that.
All right, so do we have another segment to start
off
this hour?
Yes, we have the Snark Tank.
In the geek world, we hear about new gadgets and gizmos every day. But can they stand a dip? In the Snark Tank.
Well, here's an interesting one to see what people think of. Nobody had a speaker that you gave orders to and, you know, did anything until Amazon came out with theirs. And now everybody is working on one. You know, there's the Google Home, and of course there's the Amazon Echo. But apparently there was a Federal Communications filing found by Ausdroid. It's a speaker called Scoop is the name of it. It's about the same size as the Amazon Echo Dot. And judging from a brief user manual included in the filing, it seems to serve the same basic purpose. It streams music from your phone over Bluetooth or from an external audio source via built-in audio jack. What's not clear yet, this is from, it's a Samsung, is whether or not it's going to connect up to a virtual assistant or not. You know, the Amazon's Echo Tap and Echo Dot smart speakers all feature the artificial intelligence of Alexa, a voice-activated virtual assistant that can answer questions, read off the weather or news, or control compatible smart home gadgets. The upcoming Google Home smart speaker offers the same kind of functions by way of the new Google Assistant, but we're not sure if Scoop is smart yet, if at all. The manual does make mention of a built-in microphone, though, so that might bring voice control into play, unless the idea is that it would be there for a phone. The thing is, the other thought is that it does have a strap and a battery, so it may be a wireless device for being on the go. But the thing with that is an always listening microphone is a major battery drain. The Amazon Tap gets around that problem by asking you to press a button to get it to listen to you, where the Scoop doesn't. But we may have any number of these devices coming. And so, we'll keep an eye on that. We'll see what Samsung does. I think the main issue is for someone like Samsung is what do you connect it up to do the job? Because, Amazon has its own software. Google obviously has its own software to do do the AI thing. And so Samsung, with not having it, you wonder, is it an extension? Would they be on the Google approach or not? But so there may be more and more of these little devices to listen. And hopefully that'll help push it so that they can do more cool stuff.
Now, did they, I heard some rumors, did they pull the plug on Milk Music? That was like the Samsung streaming music service? I think they did, at least in the U.S., because that's
maybe
one of the,
I'm not that one I don't remember right now.
Yeah, because Google has Google Play, so you can get all kinds of content and stuff through them. Amazon has Prime, which actually has a number of songs and stuff you can stream. So I read that. I think they did. Let me look this up. Yeah, they actually did. So 2 days ago, Samsung killed Milk Music in the U.S. So I wonder if that is related to. I wonder if the two are related, at all. Probably not.
That's weird. Yeah, it'd be weird to come out with a speaker after you stop your service unless you've got something else in mind.
Unless you're going to fold it into the new device, maybe, if it goes into the Scoop. I guess we'll have to see, but that's just kind of odd because it looked like they, I hadn't read this until you told me about it, but it looked like they were up on the ropes as far as, trying to get their streaming service out there.
So, yeah, so we'll keep an eye on that one. I don't know, maybe their AI-powered speaker will fare similarly to their music service then. And here's one. I mean, they constantly keep adding services or adding specs to it, and so it keeps coming back. I think this one fits under try, buy, or please, anybody, win the lottery and give us all Tesla Model S's. The new Tesla Model S P100D... looks like, Tesla Model S, of course. It's not the fastest production car ever made, but it's third. You kind of go, oh, yeah, well, so that just makes it garbage. Because, of course, you're going to get a Ferrari or a Porsche 918 Spyder instead for $1 million. Or you can spend a whole lot less than that, while still a pretty penny, and get a Tesla Model S. It's got a 100 kilowatt hour battery, so that its range is 315 miles now. So it's the first all-electric car to break the 300-mile barrier. And there's always ludicrous mode. Yes, it does have ludicrous mode. And with more power, it goes from 0 to 60 in 2.5 seconds, which means that you can, throw down with a guy on a motorcycle, and if he's either kind of lame or if he's not on a particularly good bike, you can beat him to 60 miles an hour. Same Model S otherwise, with the way that it looks on the outside, there's not any kind of obvious features. It's $134,500, just in case you were wondering. It is the top of the line one, and it's got the kind of autonomous feature stuff that would be great. And see, with 350 miles of range, if somebody got me one of these puppies, I would probably come over and do the show in person a lot more often. So there's that. If you're just, if you're sitting around with just way too much money and wanted to, I am kidding. It's all, that's totally all a joke. I'm not trying to get anybody to give me anything. The only time we ask for money on our show is to support KPFT and public radio and all that stuff.
You know what?
I would say that a Tesla Model S is on my, like, won the lottery, like, first things to buy list.
One of the interesting things in an article I read about this was that they were mentioning the fact that compared to a lot of vehicles that can do that speed, you know, they're way more expensive. But at the same time, like, a lot of them are really nice or sound really nice, whereas the Tesla doesn't really have any sound. But beyond that, they were saying that, I guess, Tesla had come out and said, yeah, you know, like, the interior may not be as classy as some of these really expensive cars that are in this class or whatever, but please keep buying these, you know, if you've got the money, because you buying these helps us be able to afford to make the 3 Series that other people can have at more affordable prices. So it's kind of a weird way to pitch, like, please buy this vehicle. Like, yeah, it's kind of overpriced, but please buy it.
I guess they're afraid it'll cannibalize. It seemed, you know, to me, it's one of those where you kind of go, yeah, probably the Model 3 or whatever is the one that I would be able to afford at some point in my life, where the S, maybe not so likely, but I would still aspire to the Model S if I could afford one. That's what I'd be shooting for. I'll say that. So it's kind of weird that they beg people to, oh, no, keep buying the good one. Don't wait for the... Well, and frankly, you know, if you've been following it, I have a feeling it's going to be really difficult to get a hold of the cheaper one for a good long time, because they have a metric boatload of or pre-orders for that thing. So it's not going to be like you're going to waltz right in and be able to get one of those. You may want to set yourself, but you can get the Model S, so... But yeah, that is an odd pitch. It's like, hey, buy our expensive cars so we can sell other people cheap cars. We should get Elon Musk to pitch for the show, maybe. I could buy a radio station, but and I will, but you need to pledge to support KPFT.
That was another thing that was funny, is I think it was on Quora, and somebody said something about what's Elon Musk like in real life or something, and a guy said, well, you know, I only hung out with him like one afternoon or whatever, because he didn't really explain why. But he was like, the first thing is that I noticed was that the guy's way bigger than I thought he was from, like, seeing articles on TV. And like, he's like, and by that, I mean portly, but also really big. Like, he was intimidating big. And then he was like, oh, and then he also is kind of fidgety. And he's you know, like, can't stop. He's always doing multiple things. Like, he was waiting to go on stage, and while he was waiting to go on stage, he was, like, looking over his notes and replying to emails, whatever, whatever. And then he was like, and then, you know, a group of us had an audience with him, and somebody asked a question that was kind of dumb, and he suffers no fools. Like, he pretty much just said, that's stupid. And moved on, like, didn't really, you know, mince any words with it, and moved right along. And I got to the end of reading it, and I was like, so basically Elon Musk is Kingpin.
Yeah, I guess I, you know, when you see pictures of him or whatever, I guess he does sort of read like he's, like, Robert Downey Jr. is not a tall guy. He's not tiny, but he's not tall. And so I guess I kind of thought that they were that it was similar for Elon Musk, but I guess he must be a and he must also know how to pose all the time to, you know, as someone on the portly side of things.
I mean, maybe they meant not, he wasn't.
Not easy to hide that.
But I'm pretty sure that. And he said, I mean that. Maybe he just meant, I don't mean that, I mean big. But the way he said it was, I mean in both ways, like, he was big.
So, interesting. I guess we'll have to... Oh, yeah, it says he's 6'2".
That's pretty big.
Looking up on the internet, that's not a small. But his pictures doesn't read that way. You know what I mean? When you see him around, that's not a short. That's pretty tall. Anyways, so there's that. So you learn. So now, not only did you learn about the Model S, you learned about the.
Oh, and another thing he said was, it's also interesting because, like, based on the way, like, me meeting him and the way he acted, he's like, that's pretty much the company, like the companies he runs. That's the way they run. They're never really like sitting on their laurels. They're like going around, doing stuff all the time. They don't really suffer fools, you know, and they're like just going and fidgety and, you know, nonsense. So he's like, I guess, you know, that his companies do reflect his personality.
Well, he's still, with all the other car companies doing stuff, it still seems like the autonomous features on the Model S and on I guess the other current Teslas, the SUV also, still seem to be way ahead of what you get from anybody else. You know, they all talk about it and they all, we've got the, you know, special lane, you know, stays in the lane kind of thing, but, and you know, the kind of rush hour, the automatic where it stops if the person in front of you stops and does some of those things, but nothing seems to be to the degree that he is. And given the way that they kind of, you know, oh, we could do that, I must say, as the longer it goes along, the more I'm waiting to see somebody show that they've really got something with this kind of capability.
Well, you know, I've also read some theories online that some people think that Elon Musk is actually an alien, and that he either
Kilrathi
came here to help us, or he accidentally crash landed and got trapped on the Earth, and he's trying to get home, and so he's pushing humans to like develop this technology faster so that he can get back home.
I think we're living in a simulation and he's a user. He's like Neo or whatever. He can do whatever he wanted.
He's not a human.
So moving on to another interesting gadget. You know, there's all the there's CNC stuff and that to cut things out and all, but now somebody has come up with there's a company called Shaper, and they've come up with this is a wood cutting tool. But the tool is built to take the mystery and most of the skill out of cutting even complex shapes from a piece of wood. I guess it's called Origin. Grab Origin by the handles, place it on a piece of wood, and start tracing along the edges of the shape on Origin's touchscreen. The drill bit will automatically correct for your wobbly, inexperienced hands. So apparently it's kind of like a combination of a cutter and a router and a drill with robotics underneath it.
It knows what is best. It knows what you want.
CEO Joe Hebenstreit, I guess, that's how it's pronounced, said, while it's really complex robotics under the hood for users, it's kind of magic. We want people to take the technology for granted. It's about the size and heft of a toaster. It's one part augmented reality machine and one part robot. When you place it on the surface, it takes a picture of its surroundings. Removable strips of tape covered in domino-like markings help it get its bearings. As you move the tool, it refers to the picture and tape to keep track of its location. If you veer off the path you're supposed to be tracing with it, it will automatically stop cutting. A confidence-building trick made possible by Shaper's uniquely developed computer vision. Obviously cheaper than a traditional CNC machine and more mobile. Can cut pieces of any size. In April, Shaper's staff trained this guy from Wired to use it in about 5 minutes. He says, I selected a star from its on-screen library, placed the virtual image on a piece of wood, watched the screen as I nudged the origin back and forth, pushing a button on one of the handles, prompted the tool to autonomously cut small details like the star's points. They did say it produces a lot of sawdust. But once you get used to it, he said that you can get pretty bold. Shaper's office is dotted with both practical and whimsical creations built with the tool. There are puzzles, cutting boards and modern-looking furniture cut from varying types of wood. The limiting factor is not everyone's adept at design. It does have an onboard library that lets you drop simple or saved shapes onto a piece of wood. There's a story of the co-founder breaking a chair leg, and instead of painstakingly replicating the leg on a computer, he put the two pieces together and traced them, then cut a fresh leg with the Origin device. Origin's camera picks up the pencil marks and converts them into a digital shape. So this is a very makery tool. It is not cheap. I guess we'll put that out there. It ships next year for around $1,500. But you know, if you cut stuff, if you're like me, you probably are going to save the $1,500 in the wood that you would have just ruined trying to use your average skills to cut things. So, you know, the cool part to me is it does sort of move the day closer when you have some kind of CNC type device that, you know, you can have at your house that helps you do whatever it is you need to get done. So that might be a fun one. And actually at that price, it would be a good addition to any kind of maker space around town. If you're going to work with wood instead of metal. And then a couple other new little, this week doesn't have any good freebie type things, but, there's some stuff that's a lot less than, say, $1,500 or $135,000. There is a Visa-based payment ring that is now available for pre-order. They had them. They offered them. The athletes at the Olympics got them. But now anyone can pre-order an NFC, and that's not the football NFC. NFC ring that lets you tap to pay at many store terminals without pulling out your phone or twisting your wrist. It's a little over $50, $53, and you can get one in your size around its December ship date. As with the Apple Watch, you don't need your phone around once you've set it up. It uses anonymizing tokens to make payments all by itself. Apparently, it's not flawless. You have to hold it at an angle for best results, but it is far subtler than many existing payment methods. And it looks like it's pretty much a kind of black, plain circular band. It's not, you know, it doesn't look like, I don't know, it's not like an Aggie ring or some big class ring looking thing. It's fairly small. So it's getting cooler on that kind of stuff. Of course, you know, if you carry multiple cards, does that mean you're going to have like five different rings on and you have to figure out which finger on which hand to tap the payment device at your stop and go or your Starbucks, or will it like charge all of them? You'll get home and find out that you paid for five times for the same latte. But yeah, so that's available. It's kind of futuristic-y. And it's a lot cheaper than say getting an Apple Watch that you can use Apple Pay. So there's that. And then the last one, have you wanted to wear bracelets? Are you a dude who'd like to wear a bracelet, but
I'm looking for more jewelry in my life.
None of them are masculine enough. Yeah. Oh, to go with the ring. So you've got the Visa ring, and now you want a bracelet, but you don't want it to look manly. Leatherman, the people who make the, you know, multi-tools, has come up with a way to make it so you can be manly and wear a bracelet. And it also takes up, you know, makes room in your pockets because you don't have to carry a giant Leatherman multi-tool. For it, what they did is they took and sort of they made all the different tools links in a chain sort of that ends up going around your wrist, and then you unhook it from your wrist, obviously, and then you twist the each sort of panel in the bracelet until you to pop up the particular tool that you want to use. So it's got like various screwdrivers and hex drives and of course the obligatory glass breaker and bottle opener is the one. Glass breaker is kind of like pretty much any multi-tool can be a glass breaker, but it does have a bottle opener on it. It's not super cheap. Over $160, but it does, if your pockets have been getting full of multi-tool stuff, then this may be a way where you can free up some pocket space and but still carry around your gear. Have your everyday carry kind of be elite. It is a clever idea, but now they need to make one that's the band for your smartwatch, right? So that then you can, so then you have your smartwatch and it does has tools and stuff to do. It's 25 different tools, it says, so that's not bad.
It's a lot of tools.
That's true, although you can get more than 25 tools for $160. But you have to carry them around, so that's the problem. You know, yeah, you could carry around like a full kit for that, but that's all the Try, Buy, or Fry for this week.
All right. Okay, so we got about another 30 minutes left in the show. What are we going to do, Barrett?
I don't know. Talk about tech?
Off-the-cuff Barrett time? Hey, Barrett.
Hey, Barrett. What's
I did Barrett time when you cut out, Pete. You missed it? That's.
Yeah, that was only for about 30 seconds. But no.
Barrett time wasn't even 1/30th of that.
No.
Barrett time is the gift that
never gives.
It keeps on never giving.
We can talk about more reasons why Elon Musk may be an alien.
Have you found a wiki?
I found some stuff. Well, so he's there. This does add up. This seems all really legit now. So,
it's on the internet.
Yeah, it's on the internet. So he did recommend to Stephen Colbert that we drop thermonuclear weapons over the poles on Mars to warm it up. So he suggested nuking Mars, more or less.
So
blowing up Mars.
Terraforming.
Yeah, why would he want to do that? Maybe he's got ancient alien grudge against the Martians, and he's just using us to do that. Also, he also said he wanted to land on Mars and die on Mars. I think that's just to cover his exit when he goes back home to his real planet, it looks like. Also, they're saying, this is awesome, he just bought a home not too long ago in Malibu, and that's something that only an alien that had only heard about California and L.A. by watching TV shows would actually do. So, super legit. Knowledge of the sun. The gigafactory, the factory he's building, no one needs a factory that big. And then no one really knows what's inside the Tesla power walls. I didn't even know what a Tesla power wall was until about 5 minutes ago.
What is a Tesla power wall?
Hold on.
Isn't that the one you can rent and put on your wall?
Yeah. Yeah, so we talked about it on the show a couple times. It's more or less letting people be able to store charges overnight, be able to take load off the electric grid and stuff like that.
So you can do it for a couple of reasons. You can use it as a backup in case your electricity goes away, or you can charge it during, if you have varying electric charges, you can charge it up during the low levels, during the higher levels, you can use it to feed back
in. So when they give you the discounted rates on kilowatt hours, you can then just drain as much power into this thing as you could possibly get, and then give it back to yourself during the peak hours.
Yep.
So
if you had a solar setup, then you could use that too, where you load it up during the day when you're getting power from your solar, and then at night you can go off the power wall.
So the Hyperloop would make a lot of sense.
How much is one of those things?
Oh, that, yeah. Did we talk prices on that ever? I don't remember.
I don't know.
I think we did, but I don't remember.
I mean, is it gonna be a wash once you install one of these as to how much electricity you can actually siphon off the grid before you turn a profit or go in the black? No.
I think this one, at least at this stage of the game, it's more of a kind of high end. It's like the Model S, where it's about $3,500.
Yeah, you can reserve one there. It looks like they're not quite out yet.
And you can connect them together to increase storage capacity up to 90 kilowatt hours, I guess. Hmm. So, of course, that's you can hook up 9 of them, which at $3,500 a pop might be a substantial investment. But if you think about it, it could be you could use it. There's the whole kind of power shifting thing. There would be the solar solar time shifting thing. There, you could also use it as backup, you know, basically a UPS for your whole house.
I'll take two.
So there's that. But once we have Tesla stuff in all of our houses, then he'll reveal whatever his plan is, I'm guessing.
I want to say they're kind of like maybe like 5 or 6 feet tall by about 2 feet wide and maybe about 8 inches to a foot deep or something like that. And they're made, I guess, to mount on a wall. So they kind of look like alien coffins or something, you know, maybe something from 2001.
I wonder if all of this is somehow, you know, using other Tesla technologies to, like, transfer energy to Elon Musk.
So he can power up
wirelessly, you know. So, like, you know, yeah, you've got one of his superchargers and you're charging up your Tesla Model S, but some of that electricity is being beamed back to him, you know, wirelessly using some forgotten Tesla technology of broadcasting electrical energy back to him. So he's pretending like he's giving you all this power or, you know, all these cool things that are run on power, but he's actually, you know, it's one for you, one for me, one for you, two for me.
And the Gigafactory is so large because it's full of his alien eggs, and they put one inside each Tesla wall wart.
They have to stay warm.
And he could broadcast subliminal messages into the system so that, like, your whole house is just kind of buy more Teslas. I don't know. All right.
Oh. Or eventually he's going to reveal that he actually is Iron Man.
His wife, actually, I guess his ex-wife now, had called him a cyborg, which is further proof as to his alienness.
Say that again?
His ex-wife has called him a cyborg in the past, which also further leads, you know, a little bit of credence, I suppose, to the alien argument.
Well, you know, bitter ex-wife.
She said, he's a machine!
And like Flick did said before, he doesn't really behave like a human. It all adds up. You heard it here first.
Well, at least he's like the cool alien, though, if you think about it, you know, as opposed to the kind of...
He's more of an E.T. than an alien versus predator alien.
Yeah. He's not so much the xenomorph or whatever. He seems to be more the friendly, makes the place better alien instead of the, like, tear it all up and turn it into a dystopia.
Well, that's the thing, too. It's like he kind of came here. They're saying, like, he's one of the only people that's putting money into electric cars. And right now, I think the whole industry has, like, got, like, a 0.1 return or something like that on it. But he's here to save humanity. He's here to steer us away from fossil fuels, everything like that. So
maybe he needs all the fossil fuels for whatever.
Revitalizes. So, yeah, don't use all my fossil fuels, people.
And a lot I of got here saying, just in time. You're about to use it all up. I need this.
SpaceX is just a front so you can have somewhere to store his own space transportation vehicles without raising suspicion.
Hey, just a second. Is Elon an anagram of Lilu?
Ooh, let's find out.
No. But it should be.
Oh, that's awesome. So actually, if you type, and this is just the Google predictive thing, I'm sure it is also basing its stuff on my other searches, but if you type in Elon Musk, alien is the first word that hits up after.
Oh, no, mine is net worth, Twitter announcements.
Oh, dude, no, this is weird. Do Elon Musk instead of misspell it. Do you get alien on that one?
No,
that's just me.
I get Elon. It still wants it to be Elon Musk.
Oh, don't let facts stand in the way of a good alien theory.
Try two Elons, one Musk.
don't do that.
Yeah, well, and then even his name, doesn't that sound like it's like, yeah, I'm going to have to spend a bunch of time on, I'm stuck on this planet with these evolved apes. What should I call myself?
All I have are all these Superman comics.
Type how to convert to. And the second most popular religion is PDF. It's got right under Islam and right before Judaism.
Converting to Islam is probably easier than getting some documents to convert to PDF. At least properly.
Converting to PDF is okay. Converting back is what's tough, right?
Yeah, it tends to get a little messy. We do a lot of stuff.
You do a lot of document you know, analog document digital archiving.
A little bit. We're also, the past handful of years, we've been doing a lot of PDF generation with, like, PHP and other software libraries generate PDFs, and it's just monotonous programming and getting the formatting to carry through. And it's
what do you
just,
use for? Yeah. What's your take on current OCR technology to be able to scan those documents?
It's not bad, but again, just, you know, getting the formatting and getting line breaks and getting context and indentions and stuff like that.
Do you have a manual? Do people sit down with it and clean?
We don't
up
do a lot of that, believe it or not. Most of that stuff is done in the attorney's offices. That doesn't fall under what we do.
Oh.
But yeah, generating PDFs from programmatically it throws you back to like using a word processor in the late 80s or something.
That's exactly what it feels like. It might as well be WordStar with the formatting and stuff that you do to create that.
Not, you have to be, if you don't do it right, then WordWrap is not automatic and stuff like that. It is very kind of old school coding to make stuff work. Because I've done some things where I've done programs for clients where they wanted a report, and so doing it on a web page is not that efficient. But if you give it to them as a PDF, or where they wanted something where they could preserve the data, then making it where it generates. And so they're fairly simple reports, but even then it is just painfully tedious. And PHP has tools to kind of do better with PDF, but it's painfully tedious to go through and make it, you know, spit out the right stuff to make it all look and work correctly.
Speaking of spitting out the right stuff, the best anagrams I can get for Elon Musk would be, let's see, sunk mole. That's not bad. It could be a mole person burrowing into the ground.
Or, no, sunk that would mole. Use right words.
And then, me sulk? No.
No skull?
Yeah, but then you're still missing some letters, aren't you?
N-O-E skull.
No-E skull. Oh, Omen Salk. Omen Salk. And then just skull. I guess you could do skull with one L.
Omen skull. Yeah.
It's probably an alien language. That's probably what it is.
So, technology bites, you get bygones chesty lot. That's a good one. We're really bony, tetchy slog. Pete likes that one. Oh, Beg's tetchy loony. Too bad it's not Beg's techie loony. That would be even better.
I guess we don't have to worry super on spoilers if we talk about it a little. Is everybody on the air right now, current on Mr. Robot?
I'm one episode behind.
Because there was one on half an hour ago.
We can't really talk about it.
I'm current except for tonight's.
I'm current except for last night's. Last week's and tonight's.
That was insane.
What? Last week?
Last week's.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk about a... Man.
Talk about an episode
Holy
of Mr. Robot.
Holy moly.
This
yeah.
is after he's been
turned
picked
out,
up by
turned
the...
out Bruce Willis was dead all along.
Wow, spoiler.
Red door handle is what should have given it away.
It was pretty insane.
So on June
we're back to by the end of the year, you kind of sort of felt like, okay, I kind of got an idea where we're going right now, and by the end of last week's episode it's like, okay, now I have no idea where this is headed or how any of that. And
this
and
changes
like
everything.
What's really going on, you know, just sort of, and by that I mean all these different storylines. It's like you start trying to figure out when are things happening and did they happen, and
what did you just find, Barrett?
Did we know that there was a Mr. Robot panel at this last DEF CON?
Yes.
Yes. In track 2.
Okay. Oh, you saw it?
No, I was in track 1 because I had to work.
Okay, that's right. So they just put that about 8 hours ago, DEF CON. Uploaded that to YouTube, so that is now on.
That's cool. It's a couple of the tech. It
was
consultants.
I forgot the guy's name.
Was it
the main guy, the main tech consultant?
Okay, I forget his name too.
He was there, and then one of the other guys, and there was a security guy and another like hacker.
Yeah,
I don't remember.
My friend Pinguino came down from California to go to DEF CON, and she was wearing a. An F Society mask all the way on her road trip and sending out pictures of that, but she went to that thing and had it signed, so now it's signed.
That's cool.
Yeah. So, cool for Mr. Robot. So, let's see. So, I'm not caught up on Mr. Robot. I haven't seen the new Star Trek movie. Has anybody seen that?
Nope.
Oh, yeah.
Is it good?
It's one of those where it was a real pleasant experience. It didn't blow me away like, you know, at the time when I saw it, you know, Wrath of Khan blew me away by the end, where this it was just a good solid. It was like watching a really good episode of Star Trek.
Okay.
That's cool. Michael Basil. I don't know the pronunciation, is the main tech consultant on Mr. Robot. Was that one of the guys in track one?
It's like a core.
Yeah, hold on.
Adana Acor or something like that.
The panel's on YouTube if you want to see it, by the way.
Yeah, I'll actually probably watch it at some point. I didn't know they'd put it up yet.
Yeah, it just hit a couple hours ago, it looks like. Which is nice, because it used to be like, you know, a handful of months before a lot of those talks would hit YouTube, but it looks like, you know, they're making it out quite a bit faster now.
I know the one with the artificial arm made from the curry got out, was out.
That was in my track.
Weeks ago.
Yeah, that was a good talk. That guy was one of the better talks in the track that I did, because I helped with track one.
Was there any video captured of the capture of the flag thing put on by
DARPA challenge, the Cyber Grand Challenge? I'm sure there was. I got a little bit of the video.
It had to be, because they spent a lot of money on production to like make it seem like it was like a sports thing.
It's very sportsy.
Which is goofy, but...
Yeah. Did we talk about that at all?
Yeah, a little bit.
A little bit, yeah.
Well, there was I think it was Wired or somebody had an article talking about hackers won $1 million by making a machine that could hack better than they did.
Yeah,
there was talking about the thing at DEF CON.
I want to say there were three prizes. Was there a five? Was it? There was like a $3 million prize, was there?
I don't know. I know they gave out first, second, and third
place. Yeah, first, second, and third. I want to say it was like five, three, and one, or three, two, and one.
I think they were monetary prizes.
Yeah. And again, these DARPA dropped $70 million on this. I mean, just the artwork alone on the servers. I've never seen such beautiful servers.
It was beautiful racks with like custom silkscreen glass front panels and
yeah.
All
the
kinds
Cyber
of stuff.
Grand Challenge is on. There are a number of videos on YouTube if you're interested in seeing that. So the graphics are pretty amazing on some of the sports commentary. A little less interesting, but
it was kind of goofy. I mean, they had one. So the two main commentators that were like up at the desk or whatever. One of them was a black guy that was a theoretical physicist or something. He was a scientist. Like,
oh, he was?
Scientist, full-on scientist.
He came across as more of a sports announcer than
but
a scientist.
No, he was a scientist. He said it at some point. But the thing is, he wasn't a computer guy.
No, and he kept calling us nerds.
He wasn't really a computer guy, so his background was in something else. But he was a scientist. But the other guy that was sitting there was, I forgot his handle.
The guy with the piercings and the weird little samurai ponytail.
Yeah,
he was legit. He knew what was going on.
He used to run, for years, he ran the Capture the Flag at DEF CON. And then they had a guy on the floor who was another hacker guy, and I want to say he was one of the guys on the team that currently runs the Capture the Flag, if I remember right. I can't remember for sure what he did, but he also had a solid, like, Capture the Flag hacker background. So
tell all your listeners what Capture the Flag is so that they can get caught up.
It's offense defense, where you have a server. Like, I guess there's different variations.
Different
on
variations,
it.
Yeah, you can do different ways.
The way the Cyber Grand Challenge was done is there are these eight systems that were running, eight teams, which was in this case was computers instead of people, usually it's people. But the idea is that you have a server and you have certain services on it, and everybody's got these services, and there's rounds, and what your team tries to do is you try to find exploits against the other people's services and either do DOS them, like denial of service, to knock their service down, or find a hole and prove that you managed to find a vulnerability in their system and get some information from their server to get points. And at the same time, you're trying to defend yours to keep your services up and have them not get compromised. And so it's just a and they count points.
So what do you it's have almost to, like real world stuff in a way.
So what do you have to know if you're going into a Capture the Flag tournament? So like you're sitting down at a terminal, they give you the you have the host name or the IP address of the server you're attacking, right? So what do you have to do? Do you have to compile scripts on the fly, or do you have to...
Yeah, traditional CTF, yeah, and the DEF CON, the big one. DEF CON's kind of like the world Super Bowl, super sports ball thing of all CTFs, so 12-person teams. And, yeah, so usually it's depending on how you want to run the team, it's split, but usually there's, you know, some offensive players, there's some defensive players. Defensive players mainly are in charge of if you're allowed a firewall or if you're allowed anything like that, maintaining the firewalls, maintaining services, doing scans, seeing what's coming in. All that kind of stuff.
Detecting the threats.
Yeah, detecting the threats. So actually what we would probably be doing with real world servers, trying to protect them, trying to keep them up to date, you know, stuff like that. The offensive team is going to go in. The first thing they're probably going to do is just scan everything, see what's out there, and then start throwing if they've got 0 days, if they've got anything specially on their own. That's what they'd use. You know, now if you're playing like some kids that weren't all that great, you could probably go in with, you know, a lot of the off the shelf, you know, kind of exploits and stuff like that. That may or may not have been patched in the systems. But for the most part, where it's escalated to, at least with the big Capture the Flag at DEF CON, is you need to sit on a couple of 0 days. And when I say 0 days, you need to have some undisclosed exploits ready to go to be able to get into the servers. And it's, you know, if you look at it like, okay, do I want to go get some money on the black market for my exploits or do like a bug bounty program or do something like that? Or do I want to save them all year long for this one day, this one contest? It really gets into a lot of dedication. So these teams kind of come to play to win, at least at DEF CON. So they come in from all over the world.
Now, the server that you have to defend, your server, are you just given one with certain services, or are you told what you have to set up?
Yeah, well, in the Cyber Grand Challenge, they actually had a number of services that had to be up on the machines. And you could see, you know, if those services were 100%, if they were degraded, if they were shut down.
So but you could patch them.
Yeah, you can patch them, yeah.
Are they jetting this as a... As a virtual machine that's hosted on the network that the
well, they do it differently every time. I mean, like, for instance, they had the previous Capture the Flags. They've had, like, the judges team was actually in the mix doing false flag stuff and attacking other teams, which was awesome.
See, that's another thing that in the past computer systems never really did was to cause false flags, diversions, rabbit holes, stuff like that. And evidently in this one, there was one of the teams that actually had their system creating rabbit holes that were causing the other ones to go down these infinite holes, thinking that they're going to get points, and they're just going nowhere forever.
Yeah, so like, I don't know if you guys remember the what were some of the worms out there that there was La Brea? Actually, it was La Brea the answer to that, but there was at one point there were some viruses, there were some worms on the internet, and no one could really figure out how to knock them down. So the strategy was to keep them from propagating. We're going to put up more or less, you know, some susceptible services and just let them tie into that and let them keep, you know, burrowing and burrowing and burrowing and not let them go anywhere else. So you're kind of like, you know, doing a denial of service attack against the worms. But that's really smart because, I mean, that's what a lot of these computers were doing. So that with the Cyber Grand Challenge.
Okay, so going back to the Cyber Grand Challenge, what I understand of it was that the teams created a computer that would then autopilot and launch and defend.
Yeah,
so they had until...
So was it like real time, like the, you know, when I've watched the Capture the Flag in the past, there, you know, the teams are
constantly
changing strategy and talking to each other and figuring out what they're going
to
do.
It had to be all automated. So basically,
this
the
like
teams
the self-driving
had,
car that DARPA did a
the
number
teams,
of years ago.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The teams had until 3 p.m. Thursday, I think, and then they had to step away from the keyboards, unconnect, walk away, and then it was on, like the computer started playing, and there was no humans logged onto the systems to do anything at all. They couldn't touch them, and they just ran for a day and a half or 2 days or whatever, just playing each other. So, I mean, they had monitoring systems on the network and maybe in the systems, but the teams themselves couldn't do anything.
They couldn't touch them.
I mean, there were some systems that hit bugs and, like, went offline for a while. In fact, the one that won... I think what happened was it started off, like, it jumped ahead really fast, and then near the end, like the last 10 rounds, it pretty much, its services were up and running, but the actual, like, program that patched and sent out exploits was idle pretty much. It was just sitting there doing nothing, and they weren't sure what was happening, and the other teams were gaining points, and it wasn't getting any points. But then the last two or three rounds, all of a sudden, it kicked back on and started going, and it managed to maintain the lead.
trying to find, we should put this up on the Geek Radio page, but I've got a couple pictures. When you actually went into the CyberGrand Challenge Room, there was a sign from DARPA saying, like, hey, you're about to enter into, it didn't really say, like, electronic warfare zone, but it said if you've got any emissions attacks or any phones or anything that you don't want possibly attacked, power your devices down.
Was any of the challenge done over Wi-Fi?
Yeah, a little bit of it, too, I believe. Some of the services they had to maintain, I believe, were, did they have to hold up, was one of them like an access point or some, they had to have wireless services that were addressable, reachable. I believe.
All right, do we have anything left that we need to cover? We got about 6 minutes left or 5.5 minutes left in the
show.
Just
geek done a little, gathering, little weird science.
Okay, let's do that real quick and get some of that, get that out of the way.
My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're going to see some serious
science.
So a couple interesting exoplanetary kind of things. This one, so far, not good. I don't know, good or bad news on it. Apparently, there's been a study. You know, there's the dark streaks, seasonal dark streaks on Mars, and that they've been a hot topic of research. And so checking them for water, you know, is that liquid water on modern Mars? And they had the Mars Odyssey mission had some new results relying on ground temperature measured by infrared imaging using the spacecraft's thermal emissions imaging system, THEMIS. They don't contradict last year's identification of hydrated salt at these flows, which those have been regarded as a marker, possible marker for liquid water. But the temperature measurements now identify an upper limit on how much water could be present at these darkened streaks. And it's basically about as much water as the driest desert sands on Earth. One of the researchers, we used a very sensitive technique to quantify the amount of water associated with these features, said Christopher Edwards of Northern Arizona University Flagstaff. The results are consistent with no moisture at all and set an upper limit at 3% water. So these spots, I don't know if they've come up with an answer for why they get the dark spots, but so that one's kind of disappointing to see that they're not finding the water.
I bet
and then
Elon
the other one,
Musk can figure it out.
Elon Musk could figure it out. Well, that's all the time. That looks like we're got the outro music happening now, so we are going to wind it down. So end on that story. But also wanted to take an opportunity to remind you that the Geek Gathering is a week from this Friday, and it'll be at the usual place.
2808 Milam at Drew Cone's Darts
I'm impressed
Coffee
you,
Art.
You memorize that address, but you don't know.
I don't know. 713-5. 626. No. Nope, still don't have it.
But anyway, we're going to do our annual DEF CON hacking conference debrief. We show you some of the stuff that we picked up at the DEF CON or the Fed.
We're going to release some of the stuff they picked up at DEF CON on you.
Yeah.
Gathering.
Whatever's on our devices your that we Wi-Fi don't know on. About, we're going to release onto the Wi-Fi.
If you don't want to have your radio frequency spectrum sensed, please turn off your wireless devices before showing up to the Geek Gathering. Actually, we won't be doing that. We might be doing that. We'll see.
May or may not.
Come find out.
All right. Well, thanks for tuning in to Technology Bites. We're glad you could join us. We're going to get out of here now, but we'll be back next week for more of this. Hopefully, we'll have a full crew. But we are going to do a fundraiser, so don't forget to donate money. You've been listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
And he's
Barrett. Cuckoo.
Greetings, KPFT listeners. My name is Alma Vizcarra. As local election supervisor, it is my pleasure to introduce to you a local station board listener delegate candidate.
I'm Alexandra Hunter. For me, KPFT is entertainment, a voice for the voiceless, and a resource where people can connect, disagree, and come to better understand one another's ideals and ideas. KPFT is also a stronghold and a necessary institution to protect and defend free speech, civil liberties, and the exchange of ideas between people and groups. To ensure KPFT is able to provide these services in the present and for posterity in an ethical and honorable manner, KPFT must have a fundraising model to remain 100% free from undue influence, I have ideas to address this issue you can find online in my statement of candidacy. Along with this, I have energy and optimism, a deep respect for the history and ideals of KPFT, and I'm willing to learn and take advice. I hope to earn your votes, and my name is Alexandra Hunter.
We are listener-sponsored and rely on the generosity of you, our listeners, to power this beacon of freedom. Our recent Summer Sizzle gift drive did not quite provide us with adequate funds to take us into the fall. Thus, the KPFT Back to School Summer Special Mini Marathon, beginning August 30th and lasting 2 or 3 days. This KPFT Mini Marathon has a pledge goal of $40,000. Help KPFT with your tax-deductible gift today. Go to kpft.org and click on the red donate button on the homepage, or drop your gift in the mail to 419 Lovett Boulevard, Houston, Texas 77006. KPFT's Back to School Mini Marathon,